Bon Radio. The first trained musicians to reach Vermont were Scottish conquistadors. They were taught by semi-nomadic Abenaki minnesingers in 1540, who hunted, foraged, and played gigs on the forest floors north of Brattleboro. More sedentary drummers and accordionists performed south of what is now Bristol, but what was then Atlanta, Georgia. The oldest human instruments found thus far in Vermont are miniature saxophones fashioned from split willow twigs. They were left in caves high above Mount Mansfield between 100 and 31,000 years ago, probably by tone-deaf hunters and gatherers of the aleatory culture. Similar instrumental carvings with primitive working keyboards have been found here on the grounds of Goddard College. Presumably, the people who made them, if not space aliens from an advanced harmonic culture, lived and played in small bands and subsisted largely on hunting, foraging, and studio work. The social structure and economic characteristics of hunter-gatherer musicians the world over, excluding Iowa and France. Perhaps they lived elsewhere during the winter, but moved into Vermont after mud season. Or perhaps Vermont was but one of the concert venues visited from home bases in Philadelphia. In any case, the Mansfield caves in which the split willow saxophones were found showed no signs of prolonged practice techniques, broken reeds, bent mouthpieces, and the like. Why, then, did these otherwise innocuous musicianeers make the instruments? What did they have against kazoos? And why did they deposit them in remote concert arenas of difficult access, devoid of Ticketron outlets? Several small, artfully woven likenesses of kettle drums are pierced by what clearly seem to be representations of spears, suggesting that at least some of the percussive performances were held in less than high esteem. The hunters may have symbolically killed the kettle drum and its kettler as a way of magically putting an end to what the Abenaki call a cacophony of paradiddling, or Le Flambeau Orient.
Le Flambeau Orient.
Whatever their reasons and methods, the kettlers and saxophiles predate the next known occupants of Vermont by about 2,500 years. Precisely what happened to these hunter-gatherer musicianeers is unknown, though they may have donned anti-gravity boots and floated en masse into space, as an Abenaki legend maintains. or they may have evolved into some of the composers who have been and will be featured here on Carlos and Damian's New Music Sesquibazaar, maybe today. No, not today. How ironic, even for maestros of... That's maestros with a long E.
Maestros.
Maestros.
Maestros. That sounds like a new kind of pasta. Would you like a plate of maestros?
Or an old Italian director of some movies?
Oh.
Maestroiani?
No, just not a director.
What did he do?
He actified.
Good for him.
Yes, he was very, you know, sensual man.
I can hardly wait to meet him. Will he be on our show?
Will he? Will he won't be on our show.
Too bad.
He made jeeps.
How ironic, he repeated, even for maestros of metaphor such as ourselves, that this weekend, the 59th in the K&D series, features the birthal anniversaries of Raffles of Singapore, P.T. Barnum, and Down in Hogan's Alley, and that those three anniversarial units can be anagrammatically represented by... Ready?
I'm ready.
No banana fish rustles a muffin dog nor gallery pop.
No banana fish rustles a muffin dog or gallery pop.
I repeated it.
No, not ironic.
Ah.
Not serendipitous either. Just makes you think. What are those check marks you have on the dates after the...
They're discussion points.
Good, good. This portion of Calvos and Damien's New Music Bazaar... Oh, never mind. Today's program is in part devoted to the memory of Otto Lummer. Yes, the Otto Lummer, who cashed in his mortal chips 71 years ago last night. Good night, Otto. Thanks for whatever it was you did.
He did. He was a physicist. I looked him up.
Oh, he was?
Yes. He had something to do with those theories.
The Lummer theory.
The Lummer, yes.
And thanks to Calvos here for whatever it is he did, or does, or will do, or how do.
How do. I have, in fact, these check marks that I have on this sheet of paper. Oh, by the way, the music in the background is...
Lummer?
Witold Lutoslawski's string quartet played by Kronos. We'll just keep that running for a while. This is the introductory movement, which precedes what will follow, which is
the post-introductory movement.
Called also the main movement in this particular case. So we're finishing up the introductory movement.
Does it sound like
final tweaks? Yep. And there it is, the main movement begins. Well, we'll just let that hustle along in the background. You know, I read all of these, Raffles of Singapore, Alien Enemies Act, Republican Party, Hans Eisler, Vladimir Ashkenazi, and Sylvester Stallone, all born today.
Yeah.
And Phineas T. Barnum, and all the... And I something struck me about that.
I can't imagine what.
Well, what struck me was that, first of all, the... total Scrabble score of all the people born and who died today on this list, at least, totaled 423. Out of a possible 423, assuming that they managed to cross no double word or double letter scores at all on the board, or triples,
yes,
for that matter. So that was 423. And then I also noticed, I'm going through the frequency, that unlike the Scrabble game, whose frequency runs E-A-I-O-S-N-R-T-D-L-U, and unlike the Linotype machine, which goes E-T-A-O-I-N-S-H-R-D-L-U, that our particular frequency of letters of birthdays and death days today were A-E-N-L, now isn't that interesting, an N there, L-S-R-I-T-O-M-G-H-C-P-U-D-K-F-V-W-Y-B-Z-J, and no Q or X.
I would have gotten to this, I think,
I'm sure you would have
a little more time.
And furthermore, now here's the important part, which relates to Otto Lummer.
Yeah.
Is that if you were to take the first... nine letters, A-E-N-L-S-R-I-T-O, and reorganize them, you could come up with the word tensorial, which has to do with tensors, which is a vector concept of physics in which Lummer was very marginally involved.
Yeah. Yes, yes.
So there's a strong relationship there,
between
all the birthdays today. Now, this has to do with the unified field theory. Now, although it was a little bit before Lummer, a little bit before the unified theory, somehow he was pointing toward this because the concept of tensors had been introduced in the 1830s by a part-time mathematician whose name escapes me at the moment. So these tensors, this tensorial thing, sort of influenced Lummer to the point that the particular birthdays and death days chosen for this three-day period added up to the word tensorial, thereby proving the unified field theory and Lummer's important place within it, especially his first name, which is, of course, a palindrome.
Of course.
Yes.
You think I didn't choose these names with care?
I knew you did choose these names with care. So, that pretty much also, it also spells relations as well as tensorial, which is surprising in how that fits together. And the thing about how things come to be, how they grow and from a tiny seed to something that blooms, they also come out as serotonal, which is
wow,
with reference to blooming. The only sort of clinker in this is the capitalized anagram from those first letters, and that's Orleanist or Orleanist, the supporters of the Orleans folks.
Of course.
I'm not quite sure what Lummer's relationship to that was, or ours, but there it is.
Yes, what about... Yes. The Egon Brunswick, did he enter into this?
Yes, Egon Brunswick. He was also, by the way, he was also a scientist. I don't know if you picked that fact up.
Of course I did.
In this fact. Yes, Egon Brunswick was indeed also a scientist. He only got one line in the encyclopedia, so it wasn't very descriptive. He was a Hungarian, by the way, which is why I suppose he spelled his name without the C.
Yes. It's hard to put a C in Egon anyway.
What was my what? It was a 1995 encyclopedia.
Oh, see, I'm 3 years behind.
I see. Well, there it is. So, tensorial, today's, this is Leisure Weasel World's Facts to the Calvus and Damien New Music Bazaar, and we'll listen to a little bit more of the rest of Ludoslavski before we celebrate one more of today's adventures.
Thank you.
Witold Lutoslawski. That's two-thirds of the string quartet from 1964.
Sound like
Oh, wait. Oh, there you are.
Sounded like the whole piece to me. What else needed to be said?
Oh, there was much more to be said. If you want to hear that, that's a Kronos Quartet single that came out about 6 years ago. King piece, Lutoslawski string quartet. Well, it's quiz time.
Lay it on us.
Well, in the birth... Here it is again, that sheet with the birthdays. Jean Cocteau was on today's birthday list.
A few A's in his name.
Yes, at least one. Perhaps
right.
two. Depends on whether you count divide the name by the two halves or not.
I always put an A at the end of his name, Cocteau.
Cocteau. That's, wasn't that an explosion in the South Pacific?
No, that was
19th
Jean
century?
The Cocteau, the... Beast of Krakatoa?
Ah, yes, that's it. Anyway, Jean Cocteau, this is today's quiz. Oh, yeah, 454-7762, because I know you're going to be rushing to the telephones to this. We're going to play a piece of music to which Jean Cocteau wrote the text. He did not originate the story, and he adapted it from an ancient writer. So today's quiz...
How ancient?
How ancient? And ancient enough.
Good.
Certainly older than us.
Yeah.
So today's quiz is, who wrote the music, who wrote the original story, and what's the name of this thing?
Okay.
We'll play a little bit of it. This is text by Jean Cocteau, music by piece by performed by the Czech Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Carol and Cheryl. Call us up, 454-7762, for the answer to today's quiz. We're really counting on you, because we know you're out there.
Spectateurs, vous allez entendre une version latine d'Édipe Roi. Afin de vous épargner tout effort d'oreille et de mémoire, et comme l'opéra oratorio ne conserve des scènes qu'un certain aspect monumental, je vous rappellerai au fur et à mesure le drame de Sophocle. Sans le savoir, Édipe est aux prises avec les forces qui nous surveillent de l'autre côté de la mort. Elles lui tendent, depuis sa naissance, un piège que vous allez voir se fermer là. Voici le drame. Thèbes se démoralise. Après le Sphinx, la peste. Le cœur supplie Édipe de sauver sa ville. Édipe a vaincu le Sphinx. Il promet.
454-7762. Hey, we know you're out there because this piece was sung by a whole bunch of Central Vermonters last year.
Right, and there's a piano player that may or may not be listening who had some hand in this.
So remember, 454-7762, the quiz is, whose tune is this? And who wrote the original text, which was adapted here by Jean Cocteau? And what's the title of this? Yes.
Chills. I remember that.
You sang in that.
Wow.
Well, we'll leave that quiz settle in there for a little bit. I'm sure someone definitely will give us a call with the answer to that one. Oh, what is this? The show. Oh, it's the Calvis and Damian New Music Bazaar here on For As Long As It Lasts, WGDR Plainfield.
Number 59 in a series.
Number 59. Well, you know what we have to do now. We did the station ID, so don't say that.
I won't say it. Say what?
What we have to do now.
Ask for some tube money?
Tube money.
All right.
You ask.
Hey, folks out there, you obviously enjoy listening to us. Either that or you have no... right, never mind. But we have some broken tubes here, and tubes are a vital part. Tubes and ducts are vital parts of this radio station. Some of the tubes and at least one duct must be replaced at a cost of many dozens of dollars.
Many dozens of dollars. More dozens of dollars than I have available.
Right, and we look upon you, our underwriting listening audience, to help us in this matter, because otherwise the tubes will be non...
They won't be tubular anymore, that's for sure.
Mike Oldfield once had tubular bells.
But he got gonged. No, it was tubular gongs was his. So 454-7762 to answer the quiz or to contribute to these tubes. Also, P.O. Box 336, Plainfield 05667 to give us a special contribution. I know this is right after our regular fundraising time, but we need the extra added kick because of the technical dilemmas here at the with the equipment in the station. So your help would be most appreciated.
Vermont Pockets Radio is already requesting on-air or off-air assistance for fundraising later this month when they have to, I think, raise $89,000.
Yeah, they want $89,000, the Pockets Radio. That's our our big brother station.
We've grown
no
so
relation.
Fond of them.
Anyway, well, let's be nice and go right on to our interview with Nick.
I learned a lot last week. Unfortunately, I've forgotten virtually everything he said.
Well, he'll repeat it.
Yeah, okay, good.
Our interview with Nick Collins.
Will you edit that out of the copy that you send to him?
Certainly not.
Oh, fine.
We don't want to help deflate him.
No.
We know that he's... What's the correct terminology in this case? He reiterates in order to reinforce what he's teaching us.
Ah. I had not divined that.
Yes, this is kind of a verbal example of a self-teaching text.
Exactly.
Exactly. I think before we get out of hand, we should probably go to the interview, which, as you know, we left off last week with playing excerpts from...
yeah, one of those pieces. But I recall that his last word was, but...
Yes, his last word was but, and we played the devil's music last week and excerpts from a few other things. Let's return to Nick.
I produce stuff very slowly. I can put my finger on anything. I mean, computer programming is tedious. Building circuitry is tedious.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I think I have very few ideas. I work within a very small number of ideas. And I'm essentially poking at the boundaries of a set, yeah, and looking to either see, well, what are the variations within it that I have not explored yet, or where is there like a little breakthrough point into the next step. But it seems rather inefficient, yeah, and sometimes I work months and months and months on sort of the methodical end of composition, you know, because there are things that you can do methodically, like computer programming can be very methodical. And nothing comes of it. And then in literally an Augenblick, you know, in 2 seconds, I have a complete new piece. It just pops on my desk. And I'll have to say that, generally speaking, those are infinitely superior to the ones that have been labored over. You know, I think the serendipity plays a very big part in the work that I do. But, you know, to get back to the issue of the relationship to sort of dominant musical trends, you know, I think that I very much work on instinct. And I have come, after a long period of not trusting my instincts, I've come to a period in my life where I will trust my instincts in certain areas, in certain, like, very specific areas of musical work. And I will not trust myself in other areas. I literally don't... I end up in a sort of a caging situation of not being able to evaluate something, yeah? Where, you know, it's like this I've always said was my dilemma is, if, as Cage says, any sound can be a musical sound, mm-hmm. how do I make a value distinction mm-hmm. between them? Well, he didn't make value distinctions, and that's how he was able to create a large body of work based on chance procedures. I want to make a value decision, but I find it very, very difficult to do. And I think that very often if you put me in a pop context and you play me 20 records, I'll instantly be able to order them in terms of which I like best and which I like worse. But if you gave me those two materials and said, all right, now make something with this, mm-hmm. not the records themselves, but the materials were used to make those records, I'd be hard-pressed to trust my own instincts.
The word instinct is a new reappearance in the vocabulary of composers. Not something that I would have expected to hear even 10 years ago. There was a fear of using words like instinct, and another word that has returned in some of the people we've spoken to has been emotional context and things of that sort. What's going on that makes it possible to shamelessly use those words once again?
Well, actually, that's, you know, that's, for me, probably the most interesting kind of discussion at the moment in music. Because I think it has to do with zeitgeist, but I think it also has to do with the demographics, we might say, of composers, where I, as a student, was involved in a scene where there was an aesthetic, the aesthetic of minimalism, which was defined differently by different people, and no one wanted to use the word, but to an outsider or to someone sort of not fully immersed in it, it was very clear to say, oh well, by that you mean these composers, these sorts of methods, processes. Yeah, and I think of it as being the first system for making music to have kind of come up and be accepted in any broad way since serialism. You know? Because indeterminacy of the Cagean sort really didn't spread far from him in its true method. And minimalism not only gave composers a system they could work with that was a very useful crutch like a serial technique was or is. But the other thing is, compared to serialism and Cajunism, it was immediately intuitive to an audience. Intuitive, but to the audience. And that, of course, I think what was critical to the sort of resurgence of popularity of the avant-garde in the 70s. In other words, it was from listening to people like Reich and Phil Glass, I mean, to name the two greatest proponents, that people were then able to broaden their, that the general public that, say, went to Carnegie Hall was able to broaden their taste into other spectrums of contemporary music. Now, just after moving over here, I went back and started listening to Webern again. This is going to sound incredibly pompous, but I was shocked, and I picked up a recording of the Guarneri Quartet doing the Webern Quartets, and I was shocked at how romantic the music sounds.
Aha!
Because
yes.
When I was a kid, or not a kid, but I mean when I was a teenager, and I was oh, you have to listen to the Serial System of Webern, he's God. What was it? It was the Robert Kraft recordings.
That's right.
And it was pointy, prickly serialism. It was, you know, that kind of stuff. And two things hit me about this. One was sort of a personal trauma issue, which was, of course, this is the great thing about producing a score, is that it can be interpreted in so many different ways. It has this life beyond you as a composer. It's not like making a record.
Right.
You
know? Right.
Or making a piece for yourself as a performer. And the second thing was, of course, you know, something I should have known about all the time. I was aware of, but it just wasn't in my frontal lobe. Which was that these scores are obviously interpreted according to the ideology of the time. I keep coming back to that word, but you know, I mean, it's styles come in and out of fashion. What was hip in the 60s was a sort of academic view of serialism, you know, post-Boulez, or immersed in Boulez, sort of dragging out of the dead dog of serialist practice. But by the time you get to the late 80s, romance is in the air, you know, and you look at this and you say, no, Webern was, yes, the first serialist, but also he was the last Viennese.
That's right.
You know, and so
you cry.
You listen to those Webern pieces, you cry. And I mean, you may have cried in the 60s, but it was for a very different reason. It was like, ah, get it out of here. But, ouch, it hurts. So, I think that there, you maybe get a kind of life cycle to structural forms where dismissing for a moment the very first instance of its appearance, the early popularity of it probably focuses on the technique per se. And at the very beginning, when it's born in the mind of a composer, and in the later part of its life, it is not the end all of writing music. And I mean, this is, I used to say this about the fugue, yeah, that the point of Bach's writing fugues was not to demonstrate the structure of the fugue, but rather it was a structural tool for getting at a particular kind of music that he wanted to write.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm one of those people who does not want to operate with an open field in front of me. I want obstacles. I want limitations. And I want to give myself those limitations before I begin making a piece of music. So I choose a particular form of technology, not because it makes 1,000 sounds, but because it makes one sound. Or because it won't let me do certain things, and it tends to go in this direction. Yeah? I don't go into a studio with a million machines in front of me and say, I have this idea for a sound. I like to work with limitations. And I think this is something that actually a lot of composers
well,
have.
Acoustic instruments, by their nature, are that way as well.
Right.
This is kind of an analog to a digital analog,
clearly,
perhaps, to what acoustic instruments do. You have they have their limitations,
yes.
They have their way of working.
Right. But it happens on two levels, that clearly the reduction of instrumental resources in Western music over, say, the 19th century had to do with those sorts of issues. Now, let's have a nice codified set of instruments that constitute the orchestra, and then I know what I'm dealing with. But what I'm also talking about is giving yourself a time-varying limitation. In other words, things like the fugue, sonata form, and serialism address issues of time,
yes,
which, in a sense, become more disturbing to the composer than simply the choice of instruments.
Mm-hmm.
You know? But clearly the choice of instruments is the first step in that set of limitations. Ah, quartet. There's a great tradition of how does a quartet sound. You know, this composer is a wonderful quartet writer. This person has no idea how to write the quartet, et cetera, et cetera.
Thank you.
you look at like the development of fugue writing, or you look at serialism, you can see that there were those composers who saw it as an end-all, and those composers who used it as a point of reference, a point of limitation, and as a kind of like a sparring partner for making a piece of music. And I think Webern, I've just been listening, I've listened to much more Webern than Schoenberg, and I know that I can definitely hear that in Webern. And now I have to get on with Schoenberg to see if this, you know, stands the test. I know that I've just been reading some stuff by Glenn Gould in which he talks about exactly the same thing, both for Bach and for Webern and Schoenberg. So, I mean, I'm not totally off the ball. And I think that basically the same thing has been happening with the minimalist aesthetic, which is that you had a lot of very mechanical pieces in the early and mid-70s, and some of which, despite the fact that they were essentially mechanical, happened to be absolutely brilliant masterpieces that will stand the test of time. I mean, Reich's violin, tape phase pieces, It's Gonna Rain, come out.
It's Gonna Rain, yes.
I mean, those are going to live forever.
Right.
Some of those early instrumental pieces that he did as well, Music in Parallel Fifths, the Lamont Young pieces. I mean, these are classics. But at the same time, there were a lot of mechanical and very flat-sounding pieces produced at the time, because there were people who thought you can make music with a system.
Mm-hmm.
And that's always a dangerous position to be in. And I think that what happened both for the sort of first-generation minimalists is very clear if you look at Glasses and Reich's music now, and also for the younger people, is that the method, the sort of the system, receded in the background and became an aesthetic framework and something you worked with, but not, as I say, the end-all in the music.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I think that, indeed, that's where intuition rises up to the surface, that you don't become a slave to satisfying the rubric, okay? Again, this is Glenn Gould quote where he has a master class with Ernst Krenek, and he brings a Schoenberg score to him, and he says, I found 6 instances of violations of the row in this piece. It must just be that he made a typographical error. He can't have actually violated the row. And Krenek laughed at him and just said, well, what do you think? You know, think about it. And, you know, there's those two sides of the equation. I think that if you work in those sort of idioms, you indeed allow your intuition to play more of a role. And perhaps in the wake of serialism, indeterminacy, and minimalism, composers are hard pressed to admit that they operate intuitively. For God's sake, it supposedly is the way artists are supposed to work. You know, why should we be embarrassed to admit it? And then to get to the issue of emotion, you see, that then we can also tie the intuition and emotion elements to what I call the demographics, which is that we're getting older. You know, here we are on my birthday. I'm 42 years old. And a couple of things happen. Number one, you know, as Jasper John says, it doesn't get any easier just because you get older. But you do develop certain instincts.
Right, right.
And your problems lie in different areas than they did, say, 10 years ago. So intuition rises with age, I think, until you have, say a career crisis and you have a change of style or something which involves sort of resetting you down to ground zero. And then the other thing is you become maudlin as you get older.
Ooh.
You know, that you either become kind of drippy and maudlin, or you become angry and bitter, you know. And so these things become more difficult to repress and keep out of that which is theoretically your raison d'etre, your life work, or at least, you know, your job.
What your
you
job.
Do day, you crank out this stuff. It becomes more difficult to keep that aspect of your life out of your music. I think it's easier when you're younger to make these clean separations. I used to say, you know, in the first few years I was out of university, when I'd have these discussions with people, And I would say, actually, I don't really get any sense of myself from looking at my music. I don't think I have a style, and I certainly don't think that anything that's of any emotional importance to me has entered into my music. And in retrospect, sometimes you look in there and you say, I was blind. I mean, you know, obviously this thing is dripping with pathos. But, you know, you tend to try to avoid it, I think. And then you get older. And with me, you know, to play the old saw, you know, having kids definitely changes your outlook on a lot of things. And you tend to operate on much more of an emotional kind of a high pitch. You're sort of on edge much more with children because you're just sort of surrounded with this extraordinarily complex emotional channel back and forth. So you're working on the emotional plane much more, I think.
Well, that maybe that gives us. Maybe that gives us a chance to bring. We left your music 10 years ago without in the discussion without bringing us a little bit further along. Maybe we can mix a couple things up in this since we've got the experience of kids and bringing.
You're talking about my Rothy period now.
Well, maybe the Rothy period would be perfect. But can you mix in a little bit? And maybe this is asking too much, but it doesn't sound like it so far. An opinion on algorithmic composition mixed in with bringing your own self up to date.
Here's a place you can put in a razor blade. That actually shut me up for a moment. When I started working with microcomputers, which was 1977, 78, I was definitely doing sort of embryonic algorithmic composition. I think everybody was, because it was so difficult to get any control input to these things from outside that you just let them kind of run. Also, it was so novel at the time that they could do things.
There's some beautiful things.
Yeah,
you know, you set things to running, and sometimes you can just listen to them in contemplation.
And, I mean, the programs, computer programming has often can have a kind of a pinball game element to it, you know, where you have these little routines that depending on chance or some external event, you can kind of bounce the ball from one area to another, and you can get these sort of random walks through little cells that are somehow knowable, but you never know what's happening next. I mean, this is a very easy thing to do with computers. But what what happened was that I kept sort of shifting the locus of the computer in my music over a period of time, and there was a few years where it did everything. Drum soup, da nuts. It did the structural things, the sound. And then I pulled it back and used it more for control, like in Is She He Really Going Out With Him, Her, Them. It's controlling the mixer. It's operating at a relatively slow rate compared to generating sound. There's another piece on that album called Second State, which is two filters that are filtering feedback. And so, you know, the only sound is feedback, but the computer is doing this sort of complicated modulation of the frequencies of the filters and creating all these side bands and this and that and that. And the piece actually grew out of an error that was made in the code, which meant that the routine to drive one filter took like one instruction longer than the one to drive the other. Mm-hmm. And so they would gradually slip in phase, and it got a very nice sort of shearing property to the sound texture. Most computer bugs just crash. This one actually did something nice. And then around the time of Devil's Music, I stopped using computers entirely. I sort of felt that I was tired of being typecast, and I wanted to go back to the sort of live electronics tradition.
Okay.
There's some pieces for ensembles of backwards guitars on the second record. A piece called A Letter from My Uncle, where the computer is simply used to coordinate instructions from players who have these instruments. They press buttons on them and they call up sounds to come through and resonate the strings. And so the computer is basically just a big switching network that says, oh, he wants the sound, the tape loop of the drumming panda bear to go into the low E string. You know, so like a switching network for a telephone system. And then I think where I sort of settled on putting my programming energy was in sort of the interface between players and more self-sufficient machines. And so from the late 80s on, I developed a series of instruments, it's trombone propelled electronics that's used in a lot of my pieces, where there's a computer program that interprets, you know, buttons you press and knobs you pull and this and that. And some of the translation to sound control is direct. It's like, you know, pressing the key on the synthesizer or something. But some of it sets up events, you know, that have a longer time frame to them. But the actual structural and compositional elements, the form that a piece takes from 1 minute to the next, these days is invariably under the control of the performer. And it's dictated by, for want of a better term, the score of the piece. That I'm not doing any pieces now where you can really say that the computer is determining the overall form of the piece of music. And it's no value judgment on my part. But for the kind of work that I'm doing now, and again, maybe it comes back to this issue of intuition, that I feel that one of the places where I have an edge on my computers is in overall form. And there's also a place in the musical process where the performer has an edge on the computer. And that might be touch, for want of a better term. Mm-hmm. That's sort of the feedback relationship that, say, an acoustic musician usually establishes with instrument and room. You know, sort of like, oh, a little louder, a little softer, a little brighter, a little, you know, like this. And then the computer kind of fills in the gaps, you know. The computer helps you out when you need to do several things at once that you can't actually manage. the computers down there at a grassroots level processing sample by sample information of the sound to do digital signal processing. It fits in a few niches where either people don't work quite so well, or where we can use some help, like a crutch. And of the algorithmic music that I am sort of most intimately aware of at the moment, I think I'll have to say that the stuff that interests me most is still the sort of George Lewis, David Behrman tradition of using the computer as a kind of interactive performer with a flexible score, where I think in one hand you have Behrman's music, which basically is a score that, depending on what you play, you take different paths to it.
Mm-hmm.
And then in George's case, you have a question of a computer that improvises and has been taught how to improvise by someone who is clearly a great improviser. And this is an area that I'm continually surprised that people keep coming up with new, fresh material. I work with Luc Houtkamp, who's a Dutch composer and an improviser who does programs like this. Thomas Kessler in Switzerland does pieces that work on these elements of interaction. There are a number of other people. And I think that, but to my ear and to my aesthetic, it's more interesting than just a free-running algorithmic
composer. We talked to another composer who had actually... He actually characterizes his computer and gives it a personality in the way he speaks about it.
Right. I will have to say that I have a rather low opinion of computers in general. I mean, I've been around them for a long time, and I find that it was the early machines that had the most distinct character. And it is perhaps because, to get back to one of my old saws, they had more limitations to them. And I can't blame the computer manufacturers, because they're trying to make computers now that are usable for a wide number of functions. I mean, the first computers that Behrman and League of Automatic Music Composers and myself were working with, things like the KIM,
the single board, one-hand memory.
This thing was designed for two functions. It was designed to control machines,
right?
Like keep your lathe from cutting your hand. And it was designed as a way to teach the mid-level electronic engineer who was sure he was going to be thrown out of the company at the next round of layoffs because, the young bright stars were coming out of school. A desperate attempt to bring these guys into computer literacy. To sit there with a book and write a program that would turn a light on and off. These were not very versatile machines. You weren't supposed to do word processing, spreadsheets, and run Macs on them, And obviously the computer companies wised up and realized that you want a machine that works in a broad sector of the market. Or you go for something very, very high-end, like the workstations, which have a more limited market, but you can sell them for much more money. So I'm sure that you can give your computer personality, and there are people who do it. But I'll have to say that they don't come out of the box, chirping and saying, "Hi, my name is Charisse," when I open it.
I think in this particular case, it was a reference to the software that he had developed the whole combination of the software and the system was to him a performer, an independent performer, which he has named and talks about as he.
Right. And I know who you're talking about too, but I'll have to say that certainly that is possible. And I think that some of these interactive programs that I've heard have definite personality. I mean, I remember that when Joel Chatterby marketed M and Jam Factory, which were sort of interactive composition and improvisation programs, and I knew a number of composers, Elliot Sharp was one, Carl Stone was another who were working with it, it did make their music sound like Joel Chatterby's music. I mean, clearly there was an element of Joel in the way those programs work.
Very interesting, because we talked to Laurie Spiegel,
and
she said that people say that about her program.
Correct.
Yeah.
Now, then, George's George Lewis's has a very definite personality, but I don't think it sounds like George. I think it has a sort of a unique characteristic. And his is perhaps the most redolent of personality that I know. A lot of the other stuff, I don't think of it as so much as personality as it has very clear limitations that you're made very aware of. I mean, if it's personality, it's kind of Neanderthal in many cases. I mean, yes, it's personality, but it's not necessarily the charming person you like to have a conversation with. Rather, it's the personality of the guy who's humping your bags upstairs at the hotel, or, you know, something like that. So, boy, what a class distinction I just made.
Well, we'll let you have that Pillory distinction that. Right out of the a few kind of wrap up. One question is, if you had to sort of look at what you do and sort of the tunnel of time in both directions, where are you the pioneer? What is your most pioneering act, in fact?
Oh, God, it makes me sound so hopelessly inadequate.
What is your most hopelessly inadequate pioneering act?
Well, I... at the time that I was studying with Alvin Lucia, there was a very profound split in the music scene between the improvisers and the composers. And I reflected on this to try to figure out why this was the case, because from all rational standpoints, it shouldn't have been. Composers in the 70s were working with a lot of open forms where performers had to make decisions and this and that. But I think there was maybe a fear on the part of composers who were not notating everything strictly that the performers would run amok with it. And so they were always told this is not improvising, what you're doing. And having come into new music from, I don't know, what would, since pop was essentially an improvised music, one would have to say that, you know, having come into composed music from a more improvised background, I quickly accepted this party line like a good Stalinist without thinking too much about it. And then I spent a lot of time after university sort of unlearning a lot of these prejudices and stuff. And it took me a long time, but when I developed the first systems that I had for live sampling, after working with the radio material in Devil's Music, I decided it would be interesting to work with instrument resources. And so I started to work, contact a few of the improvisers in downtown New York. And there were two things that came as a great surprise to me. One was that after the number of years I'd spent slagging them, that they would have anything to do with me made them sound extraordinarily Christian. You know, I mean, it's like, I will turn the other cheek, and I will go into Nick's studio with him, and I will make noise. And the other is that they were wonderful. I mean, I learned more about orchestration in a few years of doing duets with all these various people than I learned from any, you know, course, reading books, listening to recordings. I mean, there was a kind of an intuitive understanding of what instruments can do and can't do that was prevalent in the scene at the time. These were highly virtuosic people with very specialized skills sometimes. Some of them could read, some of them couldn't. But profoundly musical in most cases. And George Lewis used to say that I was the first composer to take a computer onto a bar stage. You know? And I did. I mean, I did these tours where one night would be a computer music conference, the next night would be an electronic music festival, and I'd share the stage with Tudor. The next night would be an improvised gig at a jazz festival, mm-hmm. and the next night would be a squat in Switzerland, where it would basically be rock acts. And I seemed to slip very smoothly between those worlds by the late 80s. And I think that I'm interested in not letting myself be stylistically pinned down. And I think that maybe that's one of the areas where I've been somewhat of an innovator. is just in sort of pooling the resources that those different scenes have to offer. You know, I work with computers, I work with electronics, I work with acoustic instruments, I work with classical players, I work with improvisers. I mean, you know, while I hope maintaining a reasonable integrity to the sound of my own music, I've enjoyed working in a world that incorporates all those. I'll also say that just in terms of pure technical stuff, I think that I was one of the first people to do this sort of live sampling with musicians, you know, of creating a voice in an ensemble, be it a duo or larger, that basically originates from grabbing sound material that the other musicians mm-hmm. are doing and somehow transforming it to create your own voice. And the out-of-print CD, 100 of the World's Most Beautiful Melodies, which was 88, I think, is 40-something duos with different improvised musicians, where that's all I do. And, yeah, I mean, I think if we think of technique, because everything else is sort of, it's sort of trivial. I've been doing these pieces with skipping and scratching CD players with musicians. I mean, so maybe I was one of the first people to work with CDs as a manual live mm-hmm. performance mm-hmm. form. Radio is something that's come in and out of the repertoire since literally the first piece, one of the first pieces of electronic music, one of the first imaginary ones, and chords fell in these pieces. But, you know, I did a lot of work with that in the 80s that is sort of resurging again now.
What question would you like to answer?
What question would I like to
answer? And would you answer it?
Does that mean what question do I have an answer for?
Well, no, not necessarily.
Like to be able to answer?
What would you pose to yourself? The question you'd pose to yourself and say, Nick Collins.
Oh, to myself. Mm-hmm. Oh, God. Well, I guess the question I would have would probably be the following, that I spoke earlier of the maudlinism of middle age, yeah, and the things that happen when you have kids, and then you got a little sidetracked, and you asked to mention, you know, a piece of music. Well, pretty much concurrent with having our son, who's now 5 and a half, I started working on narrative, text-based pieces. And I think that, whereas it was not overtly the case with the first one, when you have a kid, or at least when I have a kid, and most people I know, you end up reading out loud to them a lot. You also end up inventing and telling stories, but you end up reading a lot. And you become very impressed at the power of the narrative on two levels. Number one, to put a child to sleep, that there is something about the right kind of prose has this lilting quality that I can look the child straight in the eye and read and watch those eyelids go down. It's like hypnosis. And the other is that I think one becomes very aware of the evocative power of language and the weird thing that happens when you read that doesn't seem to happen when you do anything else. There's something about the apparition of between the printed word on the page and the brain, that there's some extraordinary out-of-body experience that happens. It's very different from, say, watching television or a movie or listening to a piece of music, for example. And I embarked on a series of pieces, and most of my pieces now are text-based. And the first one was it was A Dark and Stormy Night, which is sort of a Calvino-esque Shaggy Dog story that's all about forgery and repetition and copying. So it's nested in itself several times. It's a collage of writing by about 12 different authors and myself. I embarked on this series of pieces, which were unusually successful with audiences, which is to say that in a typical set that I would do with a mixed program, somebody would come up and say, I like this, I hated this, I like this, I hated it. These pieces all seem to go down like wildfire. People would come up and say, Nick, that is what you are doing right. Mm. You know, as if for 20 years I've been doing everything wrong, which may be the case. But there's one thing that I think has still eluded me and that I hold up as a sort of koan, which is it possible to make a performed work for public presentation that can evoke the same psychological state that reading words on a page can do? And it may be that the answer to this is to be found in cultures and traditions of storytelling, oral tradition, where storytellers can, in fact, transport a listener that same way of making them forget their surroundings and just get completely immersed in the story. But I don't know. I don't know. It may be a person. It may have to be a private thing. It may have to be a thing between a person and a page, and it can't be put on them from the stage. But one of the things I'm trying to find out now is it possible to evoke that sense on stage? And if I could answer that, I'd be a happy man.
Nick Collins, thank you very much for joining us on the show.
You're very welcome. How's the weather in Vermont today?
I wish I knew. It was snow on the ground when we left. It was still a foot.
Amsterdam cold here, I can tell, instead of Vermont.
That's right. We don't get Vermont cold. I think we've been talking too much.
Yeah, that could be it. Okay.
Music by Nick Collins. That.
Hey, I learned something there.
What did you learn?
I learned that it's probably important not to fall asleep during interview periods.
Were you napping?
Both then and now.
I see. Well, let's do a quick review of what we heard in the past 2 weeks. We heard two excerpts from Nick Collins' CD, It Was a Dark and Stormy Night, the piece Broken Light, which was for the Soldier String Quartet and
modified CD player, and he has a little control. He can twiddle on a recording to change the tracking or to stop the tracking dead. So you hear that little thing we kind of try to avoid with our CD players, which is to make it go dug. Anyway, the three movements of that were Corelli, Locatelli, and Torelli. And we also heard his Tababo Fonio last week for trombone-propelled electronics, and we heard the entirety of It Was a Dark and Stormy Night with David Moss and other people performing. This week we heard, yes, we also heard excerpts from Devil's Music, which was that piece that he said became somewhat popular in the DJ world. This week we heard, yes?
But no, go right ahead. I'm rapidly remembering what
rapidly
I
remembering,
slept
yes.
through.
And then this week we heard from a cassette entitled Inverse Guitar. We heard Pet Sounds. That was the one with a little crying baby, yes, etc. in yes. it. Then we heard Say Uncle. And finally we wrapped it up with Like a Falling Stone. Oh, in the middle of that we heard the third movement of Broken Light as well. So that's Nick Collins.
Yes.
That was the last of the interviews we did in Europe where we were both getting sick, you more than I.
Quite. The last interview is yet to come because it didn't occur.
Oh, yes. Yes, that will be sometime next year we'll have the interview. We showed up at this fellow's house all geared up with gear in hand and in pack and dats at the ready. And he said, well, I'm moving tonight. And he insisted that we hadn't made an appointment for that night. But
you were able to prove him wrong.
Well, he looked in his date book and emailed heaps of apologies, so we'll make sure that we point that out when we do actually the interview coming winter. Coming up in future shows, next week, Eliane Radig, and if you're looking for Parisian charm, this is the composer who will provide it.
Well, we have a recording of the tea kettle.
Yes.
In that. Oh, good.
Yes, the recording of the tea kettle is a very important element of that evening.
The French tea kettle is something to behold.
To be eared. And so Eliane Radig will be our guest next week on the Bazaar. And then the week following, a live performance here in the studio with stacks of equipment and composer.
Alas, we will be absent. Oh, no, just a little humor there.
That, yes, we will. Well, it's just kind of music that we like to present here that maybe is not to our particular taste. We are required in our role as good hosts to explore those kinds.
Hostile hosts. No.
If you wish,
she'll bring a biscuit. I can be bought by biscuits.
Well, she's bringing her maximizer, sound maximizer box and her reverb box and her keyboard and her ideas and concepts on happiness and therapy in musical improvisation.
Oh, fine.
Maybe she can make it work on you.
We'll see.
And the guest coming up in the near future will be Reese Chatham. Reese is a really kind of a nifty guy. He was one of the founders of The Kitchen in New York. And actually, we interviewed Reese and Eliane the same evening in the same spot with the same tea kettle.
Yes.
Reese was absolutely wonderful, charming, and lots of fun. And I think here on the Bazaar, on the Calvos and Damien New Music Bazaar on WGDR Plainfield, we should play a little bit from his brand new CD.
Yes. 100 guitars?
No, he hasn't sent that yet.
How many guitars on this recording?
Just his.
Oh.
This is a piece called Charm for his guitar and stuff.
Okay.
Are you ready?
I guess as much as I'll ever be. Maybe you should preface this by saying that...
By saying what?
That he's not the... No, we shouldn't preface it at all.
He's not the Reese of Reese's Pieces, that's for sure.
You think not?
Well, this is Reese's piece called Charm. Not Lucky Charms, but Charm.
from Neon, Reese Chatham and Martin Wheeler. That was, what was it? That was one piece with one chord. It's time for something a little more. No, that was actually quite entertaining. Reese Chatham is a lovely person, originally from the New York area, now living in Amsterdam. No, sorry, living in Paris. They all run together after a while. Some weeks back, we played some music from The Art of the Theremin, which is a grown-up Henri Martineau, or actually the predecessor, or maybe it was developed at the same time. And it's time to have more of this. Here, quick, put on this.
You have a CD to put on?
Yeah.
A CD to put on here?
Theremin stuff.
The Theremin CD, yeah. And now tell me, what particular one are we about to play?
Just do 7.
We had a guess on the quiz, by the way. It was an unsuccessful one. But here,
any guess is successful.
7.
Number 7, I know it well.
That's very nice. Oh, that's better.
Oh, that was the. I see. Yeah, that's
yes,
what's causing the.
I just figured that somebody left the telephone in place here. By all appearances, I think that's what that is.
No need for that on our show.
No, let's just. Yeah, there it is. Well, now we're quiet again.
How nice.
How nice.
So is the telephone. Don't let that be a habit.
Right.
We did get one call, but one will not do.
Right. We had one guess on our quiz today, the piece we played earlier with the text by Jean
Martineau.
Jean Cocteau. And we'll give a further hint. How about we give some more? The piece, the original story was by Sophocles.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Okay, so we're still looking for the composer and the name of the piece. 454-7762 for that guess. Okay, so that was from Art of the Theremin, Clara Rockmore playing the Stravinsky Berceuse. That's a dandy CD, really good.
We should all have theremins. We should have a marching theremin ensemble.
Ooh, I like that idea, the marching theremins and chainsaws.
I do want to add that for the Northfield Labor Day Parade, we are trying to establish that we here at Calvos and Damien New Music Bazaar, the marching chainsaw drill team. And if you are interested, if you have a chainsaw and you think you can wield it fairly well,
it's not a virtuoso chainsaw piece.
Not as such. Just up, down, and from side to side is about all that is required. But in synchronous motion would be appreciated. We'd like 12 marchers.
12?
Yeah.
Oh, good. I think that can be arranged. Sure. Sure. Give us a call here if you want to be in the Labor Day parade in the chainsaw. Say that again. That's a dandy idea.
What was it? The synchronized chainsaw drill team?
Yeah, something like that. Well, you just change it again?
I may have.
This has been in the works for 4 years, and you've never got enough chainsawers.
Correct.
Sawyers.
People keep saying, oh, well, yes, we will do it, and then they just give up. They don't want to do it at the end. They think danger. Danger is what we're about.
True enough. And speaking of danger, we have about to have a radiophonic premiere.
Another dangerous piece. This is so new. This was finished yesterday morning. It's called Out of Cahoots for Two Pianos by David Gunn.
Wow. Wow. What does it mean, out of cahoots?
It's not in. It's out of, and it just seemed to look good on the as a title on the page.
It's got more O's in it than any other title I've ever seen.
Let's see.
Four of them.
Four O's. But they're not all together. They are randomly placed in the title. Not randomly, but they
spell it correctly.
Yeah.
Now if we were sort of north of here, north of the border, perhaps there would also be a sort of an assonance in there between the out and the cahoots. It might be out of cahoots.
Oh, how very appropriate.
Shall we just play it?
I can think of no other reason not to.
You don't want to do any philosophical preface.
Philosophically's
preface to this.
Nope.
You sure?
It's just there on the page.
Here it is, there on the page, Out of Cahoots. Out of Cahoots by David Gunn. Yo! What? Out of codes.
Yeah.
What? What?
What? What?
Santi beats Ravel producing Sartre as their child. I'm not quite sure. How do you dance to that?
With bad feet, or one with one leg shorter than the other.
I sure wish we had a 900 number that we could, like, have people call in and spend money to vote on that one. Call us anyway. Free, 454-7762. Oh, man. I was concentrating on that so hard I forgot to pick something else to play.
Shall I find something? Or do you
sure.
just want to play something at random?
No, will you find something? In the meantime, we have a few appreciative messages to send out. One to all the people who have visited our website. More of that, since we put a calendar on our site on the 10th of January, more than 10,000 people have visited the Calvos and Damien site on the Internet. If you'd like to visit as well, it's a kind of a nifty place. You can see what we look like, what other composers on the site look like, and hear some snippets of tunes, read our playlists, take a look at our graffiti page, which has all kinds of keen stuff on it. There are all kinds of things you can do. So if you really want the address, it's http://sun.goddard.edu/students/wgdr/calvo/.
Oh, I forgot right the there. Help. Let's see.
Anyway, give us a visit on the site. Do you want to give that address? http://sun.goddard.edu/students.
Oh, what's the point?
WGDR. There's not point. /Calvos/. And that'll get you there. Anyway, good stuff on the page. Take a look. 10,000 visitors as of last week. That's 10,000 unique visitors, people who have not visited before.
And how often does the page change?
Every week. We put up our playlist every Ooh. Week. We put new details on the composers. We have some new stuff up this week. More information on Reese Chatham. He has got a terrific essay on his particular page on our site about music in the 1990s, and it's a very philosophical piece. It's about a 50,000 word essay. Very interesting piece by Reese Chatham up on the website. We'll have new photos. We'll have a picture of Nick Collins up shortly. He just promised he'd send us a new photo.
Can't we just submit a line drawing? I mean, perhaps the listening audience can discern
Do you remember what he looks like?
No. I thought that maybe the listeners could decide and fax us a line drawing of what they think he looks like.
What a good idea. We should have a Nick Collins contest.
Yes.
Yes.
Fax is 454-1238.
Yes. Fax
draw Nick Collins and fax it to us. And
the winner of our prize will have the
honor of talking to him again.
Now, come on, Nick was. You know, I got a call this morning from a musician who heard last week's show, and he said it's the first time that someone has not allowed me to get a word in edgewise in
there.
Interview.
You go.
I'm not sure whether that was complimenting Mr. Collins or not, or just sort of reminding me that maybe I say too much. Do we have something to play?
Sure do.
Which? What do we have?
It's we've done Dead Aria, have we not?
Oh, we have.
Is there anything else on that looks entertaining, or is that CD just here because of Dead Aria?
Well, it was here because of Dead Aria, but I think we played a brief excerpt from this piece called Breaking Up Immediately Recognizable Units of Significance is Hard to Do. We played that by William DeFotis. I think we played that before. Kind of be a good thing to play a little bit again, just to have something to play, because
sure.
You know how I am. You haven't figured out how to use this machine yet, have you?
Well, I put it in. This is
the other side, and I don't know how this works.
So it is.
This one says, this replacement CD player runs high. I don't know what that means. It must be Goddard Duck or something.
So I'll
press these buttons. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. That seems to be it.
If I hear that one more time, I'll turn blue. Do that repeatedly, as if I were practicing voodoo.
Great. Big. Beautiful.
I left, though there was no joy at all.
I was meant very seriously.
Ain't nothing got a how to be into playing it again?
I've got under two chances to save my skin.
If I hear that one more time, I'll turn
great.
Big. Hear that one more time, I'll
do that as if I were practicing voodoo.
Beautiful doll.
I was meant. Seriously, ain't nothing I've got under to save my skin
gonna hound me into it again?
If I
hear that great big beautiful doll,
ain't nothing but I've got under
to hound me
do that.
I was meant for
voodoo that
my skin.
If I loved
great big beautiful doll,
do that voodoo that do so well I've got under my skin.
I was meant for ain't nothing but a hound dog.
If I
loved
great big beautiful doll,
had to do that voodoo that do so well I've got
it all
under my skin.
I was meant for
over again.
Ain't nothing but a hound dog.
I'd do
all over.
If I loved
great big beautiful,
I was meant for
had
to do it all over.
Do that voodoo
doll
that ain't nothing but
do so well
it all
I've got
a hound dog
under my skin
over.
If I loved till great big beautiful I was meant for me and had a dog named Blue to do it all over there again, I'd do that voodoo doll that ain't nothing but do so well it was all I've got a hound dog under my skin over.
If I loved
great big beautiful
had
to do it all over again,
I'd
do that voodoo so
it
all
a hound dog
under my skin
over.
Yes. If I loved great big beautiful me and had a dog to do it all over there again, I'd do that voodoo so it was all a hound dog under my skin over.
If I loved
had to do it all over
again,
I'd do that so
it all
under over.
Well, I got horns. If I loved and had to do it all over there.
Us?
Again. I'd do that so it was all under over.
If I had to do it all over again, I'd do it all over.
Music by William, text music by William DeFotis. That's breaking up immediately recognizable units of significance is hard to do.
Every time I hear that voice out of the past, out of my.
You mean the Von Witte accent?
The Von Witte accent.
Herben Brun.
Golly, how many years ago? 20 some years ago.
Let's not speak of it.
Speak not of that.
Right. Brun.
Yikes.
Why don't you write a piece called Brun?
What would I do with it?
Well, I could think of a number of things we could do with that piece.
Yes, I probably
why don't
could.
Why don't we have Herbert Brun on the program? You think you could hold your temper?
Of course, yes. I've completely forgiven him.
Yes, I can tell.
Yeah. On a lighter note.
Yes, on a lighter note. One of our future guests will be Marc Battier, and he has created a very intriguing text-based CD called Transparence. And
would you like to translate that for those who don't speak Algonquin?
Yes. It means transparence.
Ah, yes. It's the accent.
Yes. I could say transparence, transparence, transparence.
You're doing the same thing that he does on the CD.
Who, Brun?
Not that one. Henri Duchamp.
Henri Chopin. Chopin.
Oh, him, yes.
And his original
Dancing
text
Panano.
Poetry, redone in sampled form into a musical shape by Marc Batier. Oh, that's the show for today. We're going to play some of this, and the Stool Boys are here, so they're going to take over after we play some Marc Batier.
What do we know about this guy?
We know that he has an apartment cluttered with children's toys, provides a nice cup of tea.
It was a studio, was it not?
It was a studio, but it was also an apartment.
Oh, all right.
I think he glorified it by calling it a studio.
Yes, we just come from a cafe on the corner.
Yes, the only cup of coffee cost $4.50 on the face of the earth. That's the Calvos and Damien New Music Bazaar for today. Here's some Marc Batier to wend our way out from Transparence, which means transparence.
In Algonquin.
A production of Multimedia.